Well, if you wouldn't mind just first introducing yourself, and that's going to be fun because you're obviously highly schizophrenic here. And
that's right.
Yeah.
I'm William Faulkner, winner of the Nobel Prize. Right. A lot of people expect an old Southern man. But
the real question that the audience is going to be most interested in, is it Lemony Snicket, a.k.a. Daniel Handler, or Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket?
Well, I would say it's Daniel Handler, allegedly Lemony Snicket, because Lemony Snicket never shows up, and nobody really has any proof.
Okay, that's a wrap, Sally. We're out of here.
I don't blame you. I've disappointed a great number of people in the same living room. Some of whom are married to me.
And then she drew you a picture.
That's right. Right.
Well, I'm glad we got that ironed out.
Yeah.
So, moving right on to the substance of our interview.
Yes.
My big question is, I've seen it said, it's official, it's because it's on the World Wide Web, that as a child you devoted much of your life to taxidermy and playing the harpsichord. When did you start writing stories?
I don't remember a time when I didn't want to be a writer. In the same way that I can't really remember a time before I could read, or at least before people were reading to me.
Yeah.
But it was instantaneous, as far as I can tell, and I can remember that I wanted to be a part of literature in some way. Yeah. And at a very young age, I was making up stories and stapling them together, or to try to participate in this world that so impressed me.
Have you kept any of those? Do you have any of them?
I have some of them.
Yeah.
Call them not the highest quality prose.
Right.
They're genius.
You're brilliant.
Absolutely.
But you know, of course, imitative and things like that. But I wanted to be in the game immediately with literature. And it's continually how I feel. But I don't really have there's not a story about it, because it was just always something that was happening. It was kind of like, when did you decide you'd sleep in a bed or something? I was a voracious reader, and I was also always kind of checking under the hood of literature that I liked. Which is a funny metaphor for me, because I'm totally inept at actually checking under a hood. But
we all do it. We open the hood and look.
Yeah. Try it now. That's what I wanted. I wanted to figure out how what made literature tick, or what I liked about it. The older I got, the more kind of literature classes frustrated me a little bit, because I was being exposed to all this literature, but I wasn't really interested in talking about it in the ways that you're encouraged to talk about it academically. I was encouraged. I really wanted to know how it worked, how they did it, and
can you think of an example? For me, I remember fifth grade screaming at my teacher that Animal Farm by George Orwell was stupid because animals don't talk.
Yeah.
She said, I think you're missing the point.
Right. It's stupid for many other reasons. when I was in high school, the first writer I was really loving was Carson McCullers.
Oh.
So I started reading her about eighth or ninth grade, and I thought that was a kind of magical world of things that I couldn't quite grasp. And I remember that in an English class, we were doing The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and we were supposed to be examining all this symbolism and this kind of the history of the South and how that played into different things, and I wasn't really interested in that. I mean, I thought it was vaguely interesting, but what I was curious about was how that kind of spell that she was casting on me was being cast. And I would reread it, and I would reread it. I made charts of what happened in each chapter.
Neat.
And I was really trying to figure out how it worked.
Yeah.
And I kept on doing that. And kind of the older I got, the more I was in a space where that could happen. You know, I was in college and I could begin to kind of talk about writing and think about it that way. When I teach writing classes, that's what I try to convey is, go find your favorite thing and reread it a million times until you figure out how they're doing it. And that's often a really startling and strange idea to people who want to be a writer. But every writer I know, if you say, oh, I like the part of this book that you do, they say, oh, I nicked that from this thing. You know, I took that from some book, and they don't. And it's indistinguishable from their own work because it's been transformed and they've been thinking about it so many times, but they always say, like, oh, yeah, I took that from here.
That's good to hear. So in grade school or high school, did you write any stories that ended up in the paper or circulated?
I wrote a lot of poetry by high school.
Poetry.
And in college, poetry was what I was studying.
Let me guess, Edna St. Vincent Millay.
No.
No?
I mean, she's good, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Bishop was a poet I got really interested in.
Hmm.
John Berryman. Adrienne Rich. I was interested in all kinds of poetry, but
yeah.
You know, in college that's what I was mostly doing. I won a couple poetry contests and things.
Oh.
And that I think also put me at an advantage because I was thinking about small things and how to make them better. I was thinking about how a sentence goes or maybe how a sentence doesn't go. You know, the kind of tricks and flourishes and kind of necessary breaks that poetry requires that you can forget to do in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that helped me a lot. And my poems started getting longer and longer, kind of narrative. And I was speaking with a man who was teaching me poetry, and I said, I'm having this problem. And he very gently kind of, in effect, took me across the aisle and he said, I believe you're participating in this long tradition known as prose, which has the advantage of actually being read by ordinary humans.
And they pay for it, too.
Sometimes, yeah. It doesn't guarantee you a living or anything, but it doesn't not guarantee you a living, which poetry pretty much does.
Yeah. Yeah.
So... and, you know, it wasn't as if I was unaware of fiction. And, of course, I'd always been a big lover of novels. But he kind of said, I think this is more what you're doing. And he was right. It was what I was doing.
That's neat.
Yeah, it is neat.
Okay, so screaming along to those 37 rejection notices.
Sure.
Which is almost as many as D.H. Lawrence before his first.
He turned out fine. Well, he's dead now.
See what it got him.
Before that, he was okay.
Yeah.
So, you went to work on your first books in college, or?
In college, I wrote what I guess we would now call a novella. And then I wrote a novel the year after college. And I was working hard with Kit Reed, who was my... really the only person I ever took fiction from and a real mentor for me. And while I was writing this novel, she said to me, you know, most people who learn how to write a novel end up writing a novel that they throw away. That's just how it is, because by the time you're learning how to do it, it's too late. It's too late for that novel. And I remember thinking, those poor other people. That's what I thought. I thought, surely she's not talking about me.
Of course.
Thank you for sharing this about inferior writers.
Those genetic defects.
It's sad for them, really.
Right.
I hope they won't be too embarrassed when they see me walking around knowing that I've never done that.
Yeah.
So then I threw another book away. I think we all know where that story is going.
Right.
And then I started The Basic Eight, so it was kind of my second and a half novel was The Basic Eight in terms of really working on a long project. And then, I was rejected for years by various publishers. I had a literary agent who really liked it, which was already a stroke of luck.
And you liked it. You believed in it.
Well, I mean, I believed in it as a story, and I believed in it in something that I thought was interesting. I didn't have any notion of commercial appeal or how that works. I knew very little about publishing, and I still don't know that much. And I'm still not good at guessing what people are going to like to read. I mean, it's hard enough to recommend a book to an individual, let alone some book you think 30,000 individuals are going to buy.
John Steinbeck told his publisher, no one's going to read this Grapes of Wrath, only print 5,000 and bury it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the world is littered with such books that we almost lost entirely. But so I mean, I guess I believed it. I really wanted it. You know, I didn't have a notion of like someday the world will come to my door. I thought, well, I sure hope the world comes to my door because I'm desperate and I don't know what else I will do.
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't learn auto mechanics like I should have.
Yeah, I had no backup plan. Which is also a trait in common with so many writers I know who just they didn't have anything else that they felt like they could do. And so it's more, you're kind of the last person standing in a way. Yeah. Other writers fall away.
Yeah.
At least mathematically, that should improve your chances. Still improves them from absolutely nothing to not quite nothing. But
tell us about when you learned that it was going to be published. A letter, a phone call?
My agent called me, and we had a letter from St. Martin's Press offering the least amount of money she'd ever negotiated for a work of fiction. So, it was exciting. It was also kind of shocking to me. Not that I dreamed of getting rich, but I thought, well, it's one thing to be this desperate and broke when your dreams aren't coming true, but then if you're this desperate and broken, your dreams are coming true, what in the world are you going to do?
Right.
And it was kind of for that reason that I listened to an editor who suggested that I might want to write something for children. Because my first novel is about teenagers. It's not really for teenagers, right. Although plenty of teenagers have found it. But they said, well, because you write about young people, maybe you want to write something for young people.
So I have to ask, is it apocryphal, the story about how you got your name with the telephone call? And is it
I was on the phone with a right-wing organization. Right. Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah. I often wonder where she is, the woman who was on the other end of the phone.
Is that spelled the way it sounds? Is that
spelled the way it sounds.
It's wonderful. You learn that you're going to be published. You get a book in your hand. What was that like after all that time to see your book? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw it in a store. I mean, I had it mailed in my hands, and when you have it mailed into your hands, it still feels kind of unbelievable. It's exciting, but you've also spent all this time proofreading and checking it, and you're kind of tired of it,
right,
in a way. And
right.
So it's not, you know, this happy, lighthearted moment that it is in some movie. You know, when they, oh, look,
it's
the first copy, everybody.
Yeah.
But I remember I saw it in a store, at a bookstore in New York, and that all the other books looked real, and my book looked like an old shoe or something. That's what every other book looked like. Oh, this is a bona fide piece of literature, and then this just looked like, who let that in here? And that's, it was a great lesson. There are a few things like that. They were very good lessons for me to learn that literature is not this kind of tower to which people aspire, but it's just all these people doing work. And some of it's great and some of it isn't. And nobody can agree on which parts are great and which parts aren't. And it's all work. And that, you know, things like that author was going through a hard time. And so she couldn't focus as hard on her work as possible can change literary history. You know, so that book isn't as good, and so then people didn't think of her this way, and so other people were inspired by different things, and then people rediscovered it, and they thought this, and that constant tug and pull.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at my own book and seeing how silly it was made me begin to understand exactly how things like that work.
You're prolific. I mean, your body of work is amazing, and you work obviously a great deal, or you hire. Were those all those people in that back scriptorium? Were those people working on your new books?
Yeah, faster.
Do you still have the joy in coming up with a story and seeing?
Oh yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do it if I didn't like it.
Yeah,
I have the joy and the terror. I have the excitement about doing it, and then not feeling like I know how to do it.
Yeah, every
and that's
time.
What it's, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, they're both, it's the opposite sides of the same coin, I guess, but it's the joy of having an idea and thinking, and then the terror of thinking I still haven't got any expertise. So the good news is that I haven't become jaded when I get excited about a story, but the bad news is that I don't seem to have gained any real skill at doing it either. I have to learn how to do it every time. A friend of mine said it was like when you decide you're going to try a new recipe and you have to buy some bizarre ingredient, and then it just lives on your shelf forever. There's a little jar with the special oil or the special paste, and you know how to make that thing that you learned how to make, but you don't know how to... It doesn't seem to teach you how to make the next thing. And I like that, too. I mean, it's good to have a little terror.
One of the writers we spoke with, and I don't recall who, said that in the process of every one of the books he's written, or she's written, there's this knowledge that she's the most brilliant creature on the earth and obviously has found the ultimate truth until she puts that last period on, and then the terror begins of, when she sends it out, they're going to discover I'm really an idiot.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I'm impressed she has that first part. That must feel nice. To be very confident at any stage of it.
Yeah.
No, I usually think it's... I tell myself I'm doing the best that I can do. That's how I comfort myself. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's... It feels like amateur hour every time to me.
Yeah.
And, amazing, but, you know, beats working. Yeah.
Beats working, but do you only work, what, an hour, half hour a day?
I do get to stop when I think most people want to stop. Yeah. I usually stop around 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And I feel that's where everyone wants to stop, but everybody else has to kind of fake it for a couple more hours.
Do you have a, have you developed over these years a regimen, a discipline?
I guess it doesn't feel like a regimen because it's something that I like to do. I'm not happy if I'm not doing it. So if I have a bunch of days in a row where, for whatever reason, if I'm promoting a book or if I have some travel that I need to do or whatever like that, I'm really, really hungry to get back and do it. So it doesn't feel like a regimen.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't feel, so I don't know.
Would you call it a habit?
I would call it my work. Is what I would call it. I mean, I let, you know, I get up in the morning and I have some coffee and I get my kid ready for school and then I don't know what else I'm supposed to be doing. and I like it. I'm eager to get back to it.
Yeah. Do you, when you travel or like when you're on a book tour, do you, you're obviously coming up with an idea or a phrase or something? Do you,
yeah. Oh, I have a notebook with me wherever I go.
Do you, by hand or...
By hand, yeah. No, I'm not much of a digital note taker, but by hand. It's a long, ridiculous, multi-step process, I would say, where it's that I have ideas and I put them in notebooks, and when the notebook is full, I type it up on a document on a computer, and then I print that out, trying to remember to adjust the margins to 3x5 so I can cut it out and tape it to index cards.
Oh,
and
seriously?
Then I move the index cards all around, and I'm staring at them, and then I'm starting to write the note on legal pads, and then I'm typing the legal pads into my computer, and I feel like it's the most circuitous route to having a typed text that I could imagine, but that's just how I do it.
That's great.
I guess it's great. I don't know. It's what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's true for both your adult fiction and children's work, too.
Yeah.
That's great.
There's so much beauty in writing and rewriting by hand that you can cross something out and still see it there if you need it later. Or you can see what part you fussed over a lot, and so you want to check to make sure it's not too fussy, and you can see the part that you haven't touched at all, and you want to check that, too. Yeah, it's nice. It's... And then you get to sit and type, and you're editing as you go. I don't know, it's a way I like. And it also makes me really portable, so I work in my office that's just 2 feet from here, and then I work in cafes and libraries and things like that, and I don't need anything. I have a legal pad and a pen and some index cards.
In your earlier days and starting, who were some of your influential writers, those that...
In my early days, like my childhood, or my early days of writing?
Early days of either one.
Both.
Yeah. Well, when I was a child, it was Edward Gorey and Roald Dahl and Zilpha Keeley-Snyder, and you can certainly see traces of all of them in my work now. When I was hitting adolescence, it was Carson McCullers and, Rachel Ingalls. who I still really adore. When I got to college, it was Vladimir Nabokov and Virginia Woolf. And then right after college, it was Haruki Murakami.
Wow.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm pretty voracious, and I... And even things... Even literature that I'm not that crazy about, I feel, if it's... You can steal something from it. There's always something to take from it.
Anne Houston, who you... It's an interesting thing to say when she said, even bad books will teach you good writing.
Yeah, well, bad books in some ways are kind of more inspirational to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, the good books nourish me and sustain me, and there are plenty of tricks to take from. But it's a bad book where I think, you've done that entirely wrong. I guess I better do it. I have that feeling. I'm like, if you want something done, you got to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And, I mean, A Series of Unfortunate Events was kind of all born out of a response to terrible children's books, which insist on delighting you. And it's tiresome. And so I'm something of a contrarian, so I get a lot of inspiration from books I don't like.
Yeah.
Huh. The trouble is then you have to keep reading books you don't like in order to stay inspired.
And that just makes you sad.
And you get uninspired because you're reading so many books you don't like. But if you read a good book, there's no... It can do wonderful things to your brain and to your heart, but for your work, I don't really know what it does. Because you think, well, that was really good.
Right.
What are some of the books that you said you'd like to keep at hand and refer to? What have some
What kind of
been?
Changes book by book? I mean, for this pirate book, I was really fascinated by a novel of William Maxwell's called Time Will Darken It. So I read that probably 3 or 4 times over the course of charting out and writing the first draft of the book. And then I would kind of keep it on my desk to remind myself, oh, that's what you're doing. But it's a very good example of something that I kept on my desk until one day I got bored of keeping it on my desk, or I forgot it, or I went to another town to work or something. And so, but I generally kind of do that. It's helpful for me to find something that I'm doing. If I have an idea, I think, who did this right? And then I have to read all these things. So this shelf actually above us is books that I'm saving for a different project. You know, they're just books that I keep throwing up there where I say, that sounds like the kind of thing I'm working on. And so I haven't cracked that project open yet, but that's kind of the shelf I reserve for it. And it's very exciting when I start a new project that I get to bring all these books down and look at them and think, why did I put this in this pile?
Yeah, right.
Like great Sanskrit plays. That's fascinating.
Well, there's a... I mean, I can't talk about this at all, and I hardly know what it is, really. Yeah. But I'm grasping at the hem of an idea there, and I put things about the idea up there. And... that's generally what I do, and it's... I mean, some of my closest friends who are also writers and I are always saying that to each other. If somebody says, I'm trying to do a book that does this, and we'll say, oh, 4 years ago I read this Colette book, or, you know,
right.
No one talks about this J.P. Dunleavy tiny book, but it's the perfect thing that you're trying to do. And then I think we're almost always wrong for each other. We'll say, like, that wasn't at all what I meant. But we're all thinking that way. We're all thinking, what did I just read that did something well that I want to do?
Yeah.
And to me, that's what's so wonderful about literature, is that it's there. You can go find it. And that also that it's all there on the page. Unlike, there's so much with music where you think, I'm trying to interpret Mozart in this way, and I heard there's this person who interprets Mozart the best way, but the recording isn't what I want, or I didn't get to hear it, and so there's something ineffable that you can't grasp. But I always think with writing, it's either there or it isn't there. And, you know, you can go... I don't know, I mean, this is what I teach my students all the time. If you want to write a book that feels like Mrs. Dalloway, you can read Mrs. Dalloway 12 times. You can outline it. You can talk about what's being done on every page. You can take those tricks. Maybe it'll take you a while to fit it into your own rhythm, or maybe you're not going to be able to do that, what you think, after all. But you can't say, if only I knew how she did it, if only I had many examples of Virginia Woolf working. Right. You do. You have them.
Yes. You work with students. You teach writing. You write. You write in multiple genres. You're out on the front cutting edge of storytelling in the world and history right now. One of one of those people.
Okay.
Okay, I made that. That's not true.
Yeah. But I'm listening to the charges being read against me. But I'm neither guilty nor not guilty.
Have you given any thought, or do you have any opinions about what the future is, given these remarkable changes in the technology, the means of transferring information, the way people are reading? What do you think? What do you think's going on?
Well, one thing that I'm excited about in what's going on is that I think the advantage of the web is that you can search. There's a certain kind of browsing that's lost, I think. That's the difference between going to a website that sells books and going to a bookstore. If you go to a bookstore, something catches your eye and you thought, oh, I never thought of that.
Serendipity. Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking for a book, I mean, there used to be books that were out of print that I was looking for. I just go, whenever I was in a bookstore, I would look for them. And now, what can't you find if you want it right away, right? You can find it. Even if you can't afford a Gutenberg Bible, you can find one if you want it. And I think there's a lot of small press action that you can find. You can find really interesting writers who are writing for tiny presses. And they're young writers who are working entirely outside of standard publishing system.
Yeah.
And that's exciting to me.
Yeah.
And I missed that train, kind of, because when I was that age, you could start your own publishing house, but no one knew you were doing it. You couldn't have people on the web learn of it and do that. And so I'm excited about that. I read a lot of tiny chapbooks and tiny publications, and I like that that's happening, that you can do that. I don't know if some of what feels like new forms and things like that are actually kind of the same old thing. That's what I tend to think, is mm-hmm. that for this pirate book, for instance, I was just talking about with somebody, and the pirate book opens with a narrator, and the narrator kind of vanishes into the text. Right. And I nicked that from the first chapter of Madame Bovary, which most people forget is it starts with a first-person plural narrator. It says, we were in the classroom and Charles Bovary walked in. And then it fades after a while and we're just in the story of the Bovary. And I thought it was a really interesting indirect way to introduce people, so you're not sure who you're meeting right away and what they mean. And I like that. And, Flaubert stole it from a couple of medieval manuscripts, apparently, which do that very thing, and it just disappears, and it feels very cutting edge.
Yeah.
It's not cutting edge. And I think that with many of that kind of trickery, which is means no disrespect for it, it just wasn't invented yesterday. It was invented hundreds of years ago.
But it also means when you open the hood, you actually do know what you're looking at.
I think I have a sense of how a lot of literature has gone, but it's an infinite study, so you're never going to get a whole grip on the whole enterprise. I mean, I write this column for the Bleeber magazine
mm-hmm.
called "What the Swedes Read," where I'm reading one book by each Nobel Prize winning laureate in literature, and the variety and the breadth of material is just astonishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just Greek lyric poetry traditions and Finnish epistolary novels, and there's all this stuff, and some of it is very familiar, even if it's strange and something you haven't read, and then some of it is utterly beyond the grasp of even what you're thinking of as literature. And that's really interesting. And I think often in America, with mainstream publishing getting so corporate, you have a very narrow view. And suddenly what counts as kind of diversity of literature is actually part of a very strict set of boundaries. And I think small publishers and international publishers and all these things that we have new, quite easy access to now with the web can give us more of an idea. And that's where I feel like is the future, is that interconnectedness is so much easier. I don't see, when I see kind of hyperlinks and, oh, this book has a something like that, that's interesting too, but that doesn't seem feel like the future to me. That feels like a tradition. But the idea that somebody can be inspired by something they read from an entirely different culture that they would have previously been unaware of, but mm-hmm. that they can get in the mail in 2 days and read or download instantly, that's exciting to me. That points to something that's going on.
Yeah. That's brilliant. That really is. It's exciting.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like I was just reading about someone who's making a documentary about the New York accent, and that the New York accent is fading because so many people go into New York, and they're, you know, if you're born in Nigeria and now you're living in New York, you don't sound like a cab driver from 1954. You know, I like that feeling that everything is recirculating, and that the specificity of microcultures stops being taken for the general. You start, you stop thinking, oh, everybody's like this. You start thinking, oh, everybody's like everybody. There's another thing that did that was this poet, Paul LaGault, published this hilarious, but then I think also very philosophically deep book, which was a translation of the complete poems of Emily Dickinson from English to English. And so it's basically one sentence summaries of each Emily Dickinson poem. And what it reminds you is how weird Emily Dickinson is.
Yeah.
And how she's been canonized so much that you kind of can think of her as a lonely woman who wrote in rhyme.
Right.
And then you read the poems and you think, what is she going on about? And when you think that that's one of the nucleuses of American poetry, if not of American literature,
right,
is Emily Dickinson, and that she's a complete nut job, and that her poetry is insane.
Yeah.
And then you begin to think, you know what? All good books are crazy. The whole notion of literature is crazy.
Yeah.
And it gets normalized so much that you begin to think of Emily Dickinson like she's somebody cozy on PBS.
Yeah.
When actually she's a crazed rebel.
Yeah.
And it's projects like that that I like to be reminded of how spiky and strange a jigsaw literature is.
One of the things that my little soapbox is that storytelling is the one function that separates us from virtually every other living thing on this planet. With the possible exception of cetaceans.
Yeah.
Whales may be storytellers too, but still working that one out.
I always wonder about when we talk about differences between humans and other animals, because what do we know what we're talking about?
We do
there might be a great oral tradition of mosquito poetry, which is not...
Right.
mosquito poetry. But I'm fascinated with the paintings in South France, you know, 30,000, 40,000 years ago. People talk of them as art, and I think of them as stories. These are storytellers telling the stories of migrations of the buffalo.
For me, it's why poetry is so interesting to think about, because if you chart the novel, there's arguments about where it started and what the first novels were, and it goes back.
Yeah.
Right.
But you can kind of find it. Poetry just disappears. You go backwards, and it's hitting ritual and religion and art, and it's no one knows what it is.
And
it's something somebody was muttering over and over again while they were making food, or it's something that they drew up on the wall and it reminded them of something. And I mean, so much of that cave painting, that there's some research that indicates that it was stylized. It wasn't that they couldn't draw a more realistic antelope. It's that they wanted to draw an antelope that looked like that.
Yeah.
Now, for what reason, we don't know.
Yeah.
But that's really ancient. And so it is storytelling, but I think it's connected to everything else as well. I mean, all storytelling is kind of one thing after another. I mean, it's things that are linked together, and we've decided that they go in an order, or we've decided that they add up to something or they mean something.
And our culture has a certain order. Eskimo culture that everyone lived in has a different order to their.
Well, when you read the ancient epics, they're all insane, and then you know there began to be kind of Pythagoras who said, "Okay, we got to get everything ordered," which is great. It's you know, good news when you're seeing a play because you knew it'll be over soon, but it might be bad news for other forms of literature.
A round of applause to that remark. Recommendation, thought, brilliant insight to give to an aspiring young writer who comes to you and said, "Dear master, give me one sentence."
For inspiring young writers, stop watching other writers on YouTube. How about that?
I like it.
Get back to work.
I like it.
No, I mean, I think to look at what you like and figure out how it works will make you be the kind of writer you want to be.
Yeah.
That's what I think. And there's, you know, an infinite number of perspectives to write from, and so you have to see what you like and how it works.
Yeah.
That's what I think. And to get to work.
And to get to work.
We don't know anything. We writers on YouTube, we have no idea what we're talking about. It's really
you made all this up anyway, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, we've covered all the topics that okay. you want to do, and I know you're pressured for time.
I am.
And I really, we want to really thank you for taking the time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the cookies.
You're welcome.